Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
So the reason I use the metaphor of breakup is because diet culture is what TLC would call a scrub, right? Like living on your sofa, taking all your food, all your energy, all your time, a lot of your money, and never as grateful is always like the more you give, the more I take.
Hello, and welcome to The Body Protest.
In this podcast, we combine storytelling with science to better understand our relationship with our bodies. I'm Nadia Craddock, and I'm a body image researcher.
And I'm Honey Ross, and I'm a writer. This podcast is brought to you by The Pink Protest. One, two, three.
Hi body protesters!
We're back!
Is there a doctor in the house, by any chance?
A doctor,
you say?
Who?
Where could she be? Come on, tell us the title. Give us the full title.
Dr. Nadia Craddock's in the house.
Oh my God! She did that.
Oh my goodness. Thank you so much. It's really fun. I got my certificate in the post at the weekend and it finally feels real. It's been a whole long saga because I was supposed to do my Viva last year. It obviously got cancelled because of COVID. And, you know, but here we are.
Here we are. And ready to come out.
Dr. Nadia Craddock.
Post-lockdown summer, you're going to be at the bar being like, oh yeah, it's me, Dr. Nadia Craddock. You know, you can be getting those discounts, you can be doing everything.
I don't know if a PhD doctor gets any discount, but you know,
but
who knows?
Hey, if you don't ask, you don't get. Okay,
oh dear.
We are so excited to be back. We are starting out with a bang, of course, with OG body positivity activist, Virgie Tovar.
I am losing my mind that we spoke to Virgie. I have been following her work for years, ever since my like baby body image researcher days. So when I first got into body image research, what, 5-6 years ago, I came across her work and, oh, chef's kiss, I love it. So for those of you who haven't come across Virgie's work, Virgie is an author, a speaker, and a podcaster. Her books include You Have the Right to Remain Fat, and The Self-Love Revolution, Radical Body Positivity for Girls of Colour. She also regularly contributes to Forbes, where she covers the plus size market and how to end weight discrimination at work. And her podcast, Rebel Eaters Club, is delicious. I love it so much. We're all big podcast fans, but it's really one to listen to. It's so well put together.
And, you know, not to give away too much of the interview because you're about to hear it, but, you know, we had some beautiful conversations. Virgie tells us about how she found feminism and, you know, about her gratitude towards the queer community as well as the fat positive community for teaching her the joy of abundance. It's such a beautiful, special conversation. We also chat about dating a fat positive person and the benefits that brought to Virgie's life. And we talk about how women of colour understand the connection between diet culture and other oppressive structures more readily than white women.
The whole conversation is such a treat. And I think what really strikes me about Virgie is that she's got such a gift at making heavy topics accessible and fun still. I think she's got such an exuberant character. And I don't say exuberant very often, but that is Virgie. And I mean, Honey and I, we were just talking afterwards. I mean, for weeks.
Buzzing.
We've been talking about this,
buzzing.
This episode. Just yeah. Just such a high after speaking with her. So we hope you have the same experience.
And please tune in till the very end, because Nadia is going to be blessing us with a new segment. So without further ado, here's Virgie.
I feel like a lot of people, and myself, I became familiar with your work through your TED Talk. You talk about jiggling as a young girl, and it's so moving. And I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about your relationship with your body growing up.
So to give context, I was a big baby. I was a big kid. I come from a family of big people, but I had no awareness or shame about my body until I was introduced to fat phobia at around the age of 5. But before then, I had this really amazing, magical relationship to my body that most children actually have, which is one of, you know, interacting with the world with just joy, curiosity, and pleasure. And my body was just completely integrated into who I was. I didn't have I think a lot of us, as we age and are introduced to how to have a body in our culture, we create distance from our body. But at that time, I didn't have that. And so one of my favorite things to do was to jiggle. I think specifically being a bigger kid, I had these like jiggly bits. I had fat on my arms and my cheeks and my tummy and my thighs. And I used to like to, you know, take off all my clothes and spread out my arms and legs like a starfish and just kind of jiggle as hard as I could. And I just remember the pleasure that it gave me, like that, almost like that, there's that chemical release of serotonin that I can just recall. It was like so pleasurable. And I just remember thinking that it was magic, like my body was like the water in the bathtub or at the pool. And the interesting thing is that I had actually sort of forgotten or blocked out that memory for years. And it wasn't until I was about probably 5 or 6, maybe even longer into my own anti-diet body positivity journey that I recalled that, because it just was so, I think my brain blocked it out because it was so antithetical to how I related to my body while I was in diet culture. And so I think my brain couldn't reconcile it, and it just shut that memory off, you know?
I really hear that.
Yeah. I mean, I guess from that experience, like going from that positive experience in your body as a child to then, as you alluded to, the diet space and getting caught up in with that, how did you then come out of it and then become the person you are now with the work that you do and the work that you put out in the world?
I was recently thinking about this, like, you know, when, because I sort of have my story that I normally kind of, I'm like, okay, that's how that process happened. But I was kind of thinking back, actually, and I think that the start of it was, it was even further. Like I normally associate the beginnings of the change in my relationship to my body and leaving diet culture, either with the introduction of feminism I was introduced to feminism in my early 20s, and then dating a fat positive person in my mid 20s. And normally I sort of am like, oh, it started there, but I think it started when I was 18 and I had been living in a small suburb until then with the same people who had taught me to hate my body, with the same boys who had told me that I was disgusting and a monster for years and years from the age of 5 to 18 when I graduated from high school. And then I was just so eager to get out of there. I ended up going to sort of a conservative college in kind of a rural area of California. And I really hated it. Like, I just did not fit in at all. And it was just so uncomfortable day in and day out. So I decided to kind of abdicate and flee. And I ended up moving temporarily to Italy. So I was living there and I was having realization after realization after realization. I was totally in the depths of my eating disorder while I was in Italy, but it was the first moment where I sort of realized I'm weird. I am not a good girl. I do not want to be on the straight and narrow. I do not want an office job. I do not want a husband. I do not want to buy a home. I do not want to have children. And so, you know, I'm going to have to forge my own path somehow. And I think that it was the distance, and it was just like the high vibration of travel, I guess you could call it, just like that space of being away from home that gave me that clarity. And I really think that was kind of the start, right? That was like the first moment where I was like, I have to create something different than what has been shown to me. And I would continue to diet, and I mean, I called it dieting, but it was absolutely disordered eating. It was absolutely like anorexia, like, you know, I mean, probably subclinical anorexia now, I think, in retrospect. But at the time, I just thought I was being healthy, never eating. But anyway, so that kind of was like that. I feel like that seed really sprung at that time. But then, like I said, I was introduced to feminism, which at that time, there was no critique of body weight or diet culture, but there was a critique of body image in media. And then and I really think that a turning point was dating a fat positive person. I mean, the idea that someone would not only tolerate my fatness, but celebrate my fatness and not see anything wrong with my fat body, I just never had, it was unimaginable to me at that point. And it was like, you know, he didn't really even use the language of fat positivity. He just used the language of what should be considered regular human communication, which is nothing is wrong with you, your body is fine, and nobody gets to tell you what your body looks like because that's controlling. And this just was mind-boggling at the time. And he really ended up helping me sort of start to heal from my terror of food. And he would just sit with me in the kitchen and we would make food together, and he would walk me through my fear of every single bite, every single ingredient. You know, felt like it was a threat. And he just sort of patiently did that with me and held my hand with me in that moment during that time. And then, you know, several years later, I started grad school and I started researching. I was really interested in fatness and how fatness impacted gender among women of color, who had been fat their whole lives. And through that research, I ended up finding fat activism, which really was kind of like the holy grail. Like I really was like, I have found exactly, you know, this is what I've been looking for. I mean, I think I was like an immediate convert to the church of like fabulous fatness, like immediately upon meeting the people who were in that movement, who were just like fabulous, like truly unapologetically fabulous and amazing, and who were refusing to diet and refusing to apologize for being big. And that really, I never turned back from that.
You express yourself so joyfully. I mean, you sent us a couple of photos earlier and we've just been going, oh my God, like you just make us want to do a photo shoot. Like you're so gorgeous and glorious. It's just so beautiful to see you. So, I don't know, just fully yourself. It's heaven. And, you know, I feel like you talk about the people that inspired you, you know, were there particular role models or was there a lot of it on your journey that felt like you were paving that space for yourself to almost become the role model that you didn't see?
I mean, no, I had definite role models. I think what's unfortunate maybe, or maybe not, is that they're people who no one really knows, right? They're not necessarily famous. They were just people who, like, you know, similar to me, were weirdos. A lot of the people I met in fat activism were queer people. And so they already had to create an alternative reality on kind of the edge of society. And, you know, what I love about queer community so much is that it's really an art form. It's not a reluctant, drudging, joyless process of just, you know, it's like, I think what's so powerful is the reclamation that I see all the time that I saw in fat activism, which was that we're not just going to live our lives in this abject black and white way that society really wants to push us into. We are going to be high vibration. You know, we're going to go all the way. We're going to be loud and proud. And so the people around me were those role models. I mean, they just the way that they dressed, the way that, I mean, I think it was, especially as a fat person who, like, fat people are taught not to be friends with other fat people. We're taught to avoid each other because, you know, there's this idea that we, like, look worse, quote unquote, when we're with other fat people, or we look like we're not trying hard enough or something. And And so to just even have this vibrant, large community of fat, most of them were women or femmes. I mean, just everything, right? They taught me how to adjust my clothing. They taught me how to feel confident. They taught me how to, you know, put on eyeliner. They shared like, and it was just so beautiful, right? Like, I mean, I remember at that time, fat activism was so insular and small and intimate. And there would be these like, not just clothing swaps, but there would be like lipstick swaps. There'd be shoe swaps. People would just open up their home and be like, hey, I've got 50 pairs of Fluvogs, and any fat babe who wants a pair, just come and get them. And I just remember this like lipstick makeup swap where there were probably 500 lipsticks on this dinner table. And all these fat women, all of us like fat babes, were just like hanging out, trying on lipstick. You know, we could take whatever we wanted. And it was like they were creating, it wasn't just the ideology or the mindset of abundance. They were practicing abundance. And there was something, I think what's so amazing is like that abundance mentality, that is fat positive. That is like anti-fat phobia, right? Because our culture doesn't just hate fat bodies. It hates largeness. It hates aliveness. It hates vibrancy. It hates abundance, right? Because the minute that we know that we can have abundance, the whole thing falls apart, right? Yeah. The whole system falls apart. And so I think, you know, those moments were, they were fat positive in all these different ways, like not just because we were doing it together as fat people, refusing to be separate from each other, refusing to shun each other, refusing to hate ourselves and each other, but we were also practicing this bigness, this mentality of bigness and abundance, you know, on the ground. And so those were my role models, like, you know, in terms of how I fashioned myself, really. But I think there's another component to this as well, which is that I have ideological role models, people who, again, many of them people of color, many of them queer people, who really changed how I thought about the culture. And so, and a lot of them aren't necessarily in like the fat positive or fat study space. There are people like James Baldwin and Audre Lorde, and people like Judith Butler, and, you know, people just like scholars, right? Because I've always been really interested in scholarship, and I've often looked far and wide to understand this issue, because I've always understood it as systemic. I've always understood it not as like a siloed, this isn't a body image issue. Yes, it is, like, right? Like, it is a body image issue. It is a gender issue, but it's 100% connected to colonialism and white supremacy. Mm-hmm. And so I think what was powerful at that time was that because fat scholarship and fat studies, which my work ended up being a part of, was such a baby. It was so small and so new. And I ended up kind of finding it very frustrating, where I was like, where's the intersectionality? I think what's hard, like when a body of scholarship or, you know, a department or something is emerging in an academic setting, the first thing you have to do is you have to set up the basics, right? Like, this is what fat studies is. This is how we study it, right? So it was very much in that 101. It felt to me like that 101 foundational space. And I was ready to be like, how do we connect this to like intergalactic, you know, interplanetary connection, metaphysical, beyond the planes. I was already there. And so I ended up having to turn to people who are so good at world building. Again, mostly people of color, mostly queer people.
I mean, I think that's so powerful. And I think something over the course of what you were saying that's really struck me, and I think is really important, is that there's not just a single turning point in people's journey from being trapped in diet culture and having struggles and difficulties with their bodies and their relationship with food. You spoke about the distance and being in Italy, and then the feminist scholarship, and then the fat positive partner, and then going into graduate school. There's all of these touch points, and they build on each other. So it's not just a one thing or a one fix. It's all of these things. It's easy to look and be like, oh, that's what I want. And it's, I think, just having that laid out, I think, is really useful for people to hear. I mean, so much with like the fat community, the queer community, as you mentioned, and that vibrancy, and finding people who, I love the word you use, the word vibrate. that's a really smart word for the energy coming off.
Well, I guess, and finding your weirdos, you know, finding the people that make you feel like, wow, I found my people. And I think, yeah, God, I so relate to when I first became friends with other fat women. I was like, oh, we can do this. This, you know,
yes, and just being, yes.
It's so liberating. And just being like, they get it. They get like the summer chafe. They get all of the stuff that we've never been allowed to talk about. And it's so liberating. And you just feel like you don't have to do it alone.
So many people feel like they're a weirdo or a misfit, but it's just finding your community, right? It's just finding the people where you belong.
Completely.
There is the moment where you have to decide that you're opting out. You know, I think that you do have to have that moment. And I do, I 100% believe like most of us want to opt out. Most of us want to get off this ride. It's not fun for most people. Yeah. And so I think that for me, it was like slowly disavowing. How would I put it? It's like you're when it's kind of like when you have to renounce citizenship to a country. in order to get like, you know, whatever, some countries expect that from you if you want citizenship in their country. But it's kind of like that. You do have to have that moment where you cross the line and you're like, I'm not interested in this building into this project that has been laid out before me, that has hurt me and hurt so many others. I primarily work with people who identify as women. I know how much fear there is in just taking that step out. And I think that it's such a liberating moment. It's like we have all this terror of it. And then when it happens, you're like, oh my God, this is the best thing ever.
Well, it's interesting when you were like, you know, we're taught as fat people to stay away from other fat people. And it's like, well, it's like they want to keep us away from each other. So we don't know how fucking good it is when we're reunited. Or so we can't unionize.
Yes, 100%, 100%.
I love the analogy of losing the citizenship. And I think that another analogy in some of your work that both Honey and I have spoken about that we really like is the analogy of breaking up with diet culture. And you say like you have to have that intention of like this is something where I do want to opt out. But for people who are currently still feeling trapped, how can they start that breakup process?
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of it starts with mindset. So the reason I use the metaphor of breakup is because diet culture is what TLC would call a scrub, right? Like living on your sofa, taking all your food, all your energy, all your time, a lot of your money, and never is grateful is always like the more you give, the more I take. Right? Which is like a dominatrix rule that I love. It's just like, but in the case of diet culture, it's like, you know, it's like that ungrateful, leeching boyfriend. And I think a lot of us really, like when we're still in diet culture, we think that he's like a prize. Like we think that he is like, everybody's looking at us like, hey, like that y'all look great. There's people who are always going to be, who have those optics, right? Or not, maybe not optics, but have that lens, right? Mm. And I think that, you know, when you can shift and recognize, but wait, what am I actually getting from this? What am I actually getting from this? And I think that's the moment where things shift. And I had this conversation the other day. It was really, really powerful with a fat woman. And she was talking about how one of the things that kept her in diet culture was men, was the desire for relationship with a cishet man. And she sort of, and she was reflecting on how absolutely in her own disordered eating, and she also has some gastrointestinal issues that have created really intense stress upon her body that have led to weight loss that was really scary for her and really negative for her, and involved like literally just throwing up every single thing that she ate, like out of her control, right? Just her body just did something the doctors still don't understand what happened. And so she's talking about being in the depths of terror and an illness and men just flocking to her in that state. And I've just talked to so many women who have that experience where it's like they either are in the depths of a drug addiction because they're trying to control their weight through using meth, for example, or they're very, very ill and their body has deteriorated because of an illness. And men are just giving them so much love in those periods. And And she sort of, the thing that was really poignant that she kind of concluded on was she said, you know, what did dieting give me? It attracted assholes. It gave me a gastrointestinal disorder. Most likely was connected to like my issues with dieting and disordered eating, right? It attracted like abusive people. And I think what's important to recognize is like, even if you are getting the quote unquote, I call them prizes or privilege that diet culture is supposed to give you, take a step back and see, what are you actually getting, right? Maybe you have the, maybe on the out, like from the outside in, you look like you have it all together, but like, are you actually happy? Is this, is your partner totally cool with you starving yourself and not being hungry, like being hungry all the time? Is that a partnership that you want to fight for? I think that was the thing for me, like when, you know, in the depths of my eating disorder and then, you know, getting the privileges and the prizes that I had always dreamed of having, it was completely soured by the fact that I'm like, how are you, man by my side who says that they love me, totally not noticing that I never eat, totally not noticing wow. that I am hungry all the time, totally fine with the fact that when we go out to a restaurant, I don't order any food. And so I think for me, it's like, you know, again, like kind of assessing what are you actually getting out of this and being really, really brutally honest with yourself, because the truth is I don't even have to know you to know, because like diet culture is violence, it's colonialism, it's white supremacy, it's misogyny. Good things do not come from those things. Right? Like good things don't, like, I'm always like, poop garbage only begets poop garbage. That is the rule. That is physics, chemistry. That is the rule of like the universe, right? Like, and so I don't have to know you to know that if that is the practice that you are engaging to get the things that you want, there's something spiritually being stolen from you, because these systems are meant to destroy the spirit. For that person who's still afraid, it makes complete sense that you're afraid. We live in a culture where you're taught the worst thing that you could be in the world is to be a fat person. But I think I would argue, right, the worst thing in the world that you could be is someone who is hungry, who is in the depths of self-hatred and feel like they can't get out. That is much worse. And so that's what I think I would say to that person.
Yeah, what an answer. And I love how you combine the storytelling and the science with the poop garbage, baguettes, poop garbage, because combining the storytelling and the science is very much the ethos of the body protest, and you just did that so beautifully.
So obviously you talked about earlier being a contributor for Forbes, and you write about the plus size market. And I feel like there's such a conversation at the moment specifically, but, you know, and it's been growing in the last couple of years of, you know, what is an inclusive brand? How would you define an inclusive brand, and what are the standards we should be holding brands to?
Yeah, I mean, I've been slowly but surely learning a lot of language things. So like inclusive is a very specific word that means a specific thing, and extended sizing means a very specific thing. And I think for the layperson, it's a little bit complicated to understand. But yeah, there's a whole fashion lingo that I'm again still learning. So but I think, you know, the spirit of the question is really like, you know, what should we be looking for? And I really, I mean, I'm immediately thinking about a brand called Superfit Hero that recently truly blew my mind. I'm thinking of two examples that really blew my mind. The first one, Superfit Hero, they had been offering extra small to 6X, I believe, for quite a long time, and then recently made the decision to extend to 10X, and specifically said, we have limited resources as a company, and we are going to dedicate those resources to extending our sizing upward. And in that vein, because we have limited resources, we are getting rid of extra small, small, and medium. And I just found that was like That was like so extraordinary, right? To sort of say we are letting go of the people who, according to the data, market data, are the biggest customers. And I think, right, their clients or customers who were in that size range were really disappointed. I mean, obviously, I understand they make it a great product, so it makes complete sense that those customers would be disappointed. But I think what was extraordinary, right, in an ideal world, Superfit Hero would have all the money, all the time, all the personnel to make sizes for like every kind of body. But they sat down and they were like, here are our limitations, and here's what we're doing with that information. And I found that like those kind of decisions where you're like, where, you know, you're starting out, you're a smaller company, you're hoping to expand, but we all understand that every single person, and yes, even huge companies, have their limitations, and it's important to know they are making a decision to cater to extra small, medium, right? And I think what that, even that news item, as someone who's been doing this work for 10 years, it blew my mind to be like, what? You can choose not to do small, extra small, medium? What, like, what is this world where, like, because I think that there was absolutely this internalized fat phobia that it's so much to ask for anything beyond like an XL. It's so much, if anything beyond a 3X, what? Like, you know, I like it, just it's presented as if it's like impossible. And then in reality, right, the companies are just continuously choosing to do that. So I think it really unveiled a few things. The second example I'm thinking of that truly like mind-boggling was the also an athletic wear brand called Athleta. They're associated with like Gap and Banana Republic. They're like the athletic arm of that sort of, I don't know, conglomerate or whatever you want to call it. So they did a few things that were amazing. One, they're like, we have 500 employees nationwide. We are training every single one of them on body positive language.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. They have to go through a training program that helps them not use fat phobic language just in relationship to their clothing, right? Like it's just a fit. It's literally just a fit tutorial. How to not use biased language. The other thing they're doing is that they're having their executives go through training, anti-bias training. And then they decided to put up a billboard in Times Square with a plus size person as a central person in the campaign. And that person started to get harassed a lot online, and they doubled down and defended her. As
that's
a company.
So good. It's so refreshing.
Yeah, totally. And then I think like the last thing I want to say is that truly like was mind boggling. I was on like a call with their people, like a press call. And like I had this moment where like jaw drop, where one of the like the executive people was like, our plus size customer spends 90% more than our straight size customer, and she comes back twice as often. And I think, you know, for me, like, again, there's this idea. I mean, first of all, right, there's this myth that there's a thin majority. Like certainly they just don't exist, right? Like literally. So like in the United States, about 70% of US women are plus size.
UK average is size 16,
I believe. Yeah.
UN plus size, but still.
Yeah, so I feel like we have this idea in fashion that we're like showing up to the conversation hat in hand, without the 70% of the people behind us. And I think that we need to flip that mindset, and just sort of demand from a place of like, you're being weird for trying to pretend there's a majority that there isn't. So for me, it's like companies who are making those kinds of moves, whether it is, and for me, I'm not a purist, right? I'm like, if you're doing this because you're ideologically driven, that's awesome. Like, I'm like, that's fucking awesome. And if you're doing it just because you looked at the numbers and it's obvious, cool, I'm also good with that. So I think you think about like the two examples I gave, I think for sure Superfit Hero was like very ideologically driven, and they're very overt about being political. They're very overt. They use political language. They use the word fat. They're very clear. Like the CEO is like very political and very clear about it. And Athleta is more of a traditional, you know, athleisure brand that just sat down with the numbers and were like, it's ridiculous not to serve this client. So we're going to do what we have to do to make sure that she comes back and feels welcome. And so anyway, so those are my like things that I've loved learning about, like, since I've been contributing for Forbes.
I so love hearing you say that, no, you're being weird, because my entire life I have felt gaslit by looking at, you know,
yes.
I'm sure you've expressed it, that you see, you know, the plus size clothes that always sell out first online, always.
Yes.
The biggest yes. sizes are always sold out. It's because we are the majority, and it's like, why yes. are we not being catered to? And it's so, you know, it's so amazing to hear you talk about this, and I'm so thrilled that you're covering this in Forbes. Like, it makes me so happy about the future.
Yes, me too.
There's just, as you say, such a clear business case for it. And with that first example about the choosing to not have the smaller range and go and extend up, because I think that's what we hear so much from brands, is like, oh, you know, we're limited, and so that's why we can't go beyond a 16, beyond an 18. Like, I don't know, we only have limited resources, so we can't do anything more, but we're going to change our offering is really powerful, I think.
Yeah, I mean, totally. And I want to be clear, like, I think doing so much writing in this space has taught me it absolutely is. I mean, unfortunately, because the fashion industry is so fat phobic, just from top to bottom, it goes all the way from fashion school all the way up. They don't want to teach plus size patterning in fashion school. You're just on your own. If you want to make plus size clothing as a designer in fashion school, you're on your own to try and figure it out. So, I mean, that's absolutely real. And absolutely, again, like the machinery, like, for example, if your clothing requires complex machinery that is very expensive, right? Those costs are very real. But I think it's important to say, you know, there's this idea that, you know, you do have a certain number of resources. You can choose to do what you feel like as a company your vision is. This idea that you have nothing and are therefore, you know, like, have your hands tied behind your back. That's not the whole story. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's this, I think we really do need to start troubling, like, well, do you need to sell extra small, small and medium? Because that market is very, very, very well taken care of. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you want to take the resources that you have and allocate them differently and learn how to sort of do the things that you need to do to accommodate a different kind of customer, you 100% can do that. And it might take a little bit longer, right? Like, I think I'm thinking about, not to get too into the weeds on this, but I was talking to someone else who makes anti-chafing shorts for people of all sizes. And she was talking about how there's this machine, it's a knitting machine, and it's a tube. If you want to create seamless undergarments, which she really wanted to do because she was really concerned with comfort, she wanted to create a seamless undergarment. So you have to have a very special machine, which costs like $100,000. And she was like, a lot of people cheat and they'll say it's a 3X, 4X, but it's actually only, the machine is only supposed to make a 1X. And so she's like, so we went out of our way to go through the funding cycles and get the whole, and it's like, right, like, I think it goes to show that if you're driven to do this, right, if she was happy to approach people, be innovative, be a little bit scrappy, get some crowdfunding going, right, she was totally happy to do that legwork. She's just one person, like, she's one CEO, right? And so she was happy to do it. And so I think it's important to just recognize, right, like, there are costs attached, and also, if you're a CEO, you're an innovative motherfucker. You can figure this out.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, 100%. No, it's like, we should be, I don't want to say challenging, but yeah, challenging our CEOs to be more innovative and to be pushing, I mean, to be pushing the size.
Yes.
I just think it's like, why are we not? And it's like, it is such a huge market, and it is a market that will be loyal in return because it's such a scarce market. So it's like, I, you know, it just makes sense.
Right. And to that point of innovation, because I've had similar conversations, but with people in fashion, but also advertising and beauty. And one CEO from the beauty industry said almost exactly that point in terms of doing this work, in terms of being more inclusive. They said, we're world leaders in terms of making sure and being, we're so competitive in terms of our product.
Right,
so yes. much energy in terms of the product that we're competitive on the market. But can we also be competitive on our inclusiveness, on our social responsibility, on our social purpose stuff? And I think, again, it's so, like, it almost feels like a no-brainer when you put it like that, because it's like, yeah, we've got some of the best minds in the top of business doing those kinds of things, making those kinds of decisions. And we've seen, again, as we've discussed, it's like you're leaving dollars on the table if you're not catering to 70% of your potential market.
Yeah, absolutely.
Virgie, I would love to ask you about your most recent book, Self-Love Revolution, Radical Body Positivity for Girls of Color. And I'm curious why it felt important to focus on girls of color specifically when talking about body positivity.
Yeah, I mean, I think that even to this day, the conversation around disordered eating or on body image, it really is portrayed as a white issue, as a white woman and a white girl's issue. And I think in actuality, right, like we know because of racism, white supremacy and anti-blackness, right, that like absolutely girls of color have body image issues, you know, have issues with food, have issues with all of these things, right? And so I think it was like political to even just say, to demarcate the space as like, this is not just a white woman's issue. And then I think specifically to talk, to have time and space to really focus on how connected racism and white supremacy is to how we see ourselves. And I think a lot of times, and I've been trying to grapple with whether it's self-imposed or if it's a real thing, I do feel pressure to kind of move along fairly quickly on the conversation around how connected whiteness and white supremacy are to diet culture and to fat phobia. And it felt so powerful to kind of, you know, just have a whole book dedicated to that lens being front and center. I mean, you can kind of imagine almost like a lot of books that are focused on this issue, they'll kind of maybe have one chapter that's like on intersectionality, or maybe one interview or something like that. And so I just love that it was like this opportunity to talk to girls of color. And I think what was powerful was before, you know, in preparation for writing the book, I talked to lots of young women. That was so illuminating. They just like had so much wisdom and so much language around what was happening. And it absolutely, like I tried to honor that when I was writing the book. And I think the other thing was like, I was realizing so much for me, it felt so nourishing in a way that I wasn't expecting to be able to write just to a brown and black audience. Like I could, I don't know how to explain it, right? I think a lot of times, again, I do feel pressure to speak to a white audience or a thin audience or like whatever the perceived majority person is at whatever publishing place I might be doing work with. And I really felt like, oh my God, this feels so good to just sort of be like, I think about the person I'm writing this book for and I relate to her. Like I there are a lot, I can look in the mirror and kind of say like, I'm talking to the younger version of myself with the specific dynamics that I face and I faced as a girl. I think like one of the things that's really important to understand is that, you know, girls of color, like their position to diet culture is just really different than for white young girls, for girls and young women. And girls of color engage in diet culture for different reasons. And a lot, right, like I think a lot of it is subconscious, in the sense that, you know, when you are a brown or black person, one of the things that you can do to perform assimilation is to be dieting and exercising all the time because it is highly valued by this white society. And health, like quote unquote health, which in our culture means a thin body, is currency. So people of color can navigate the white world more easily if they're seen as less threatening. And dieting and engaging in dieting is part of that process. And so I think those kind of nuances were at the heart of this book. And I think specifically talking to girls of color from the place of like one of the most damaging things that racism does is that it teaches you, it makes you feel like you're just bad and dirty. And I really wanted to get to the core of like, you're not bad, you're good. You're not dirty, you're not wrong, you're not weak. I think that, right, like, what, again, another thing that racism does is that it erodes at our sense of power. And I just sort of wanted to create a little something that was there to say, you can trust your body, you are powerful, you can listen to your intuition, you are connected to the universe, you are made of stardust. All of the things that, frankly, girls of color don't get told. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that the darker you are, the more adultified you are. And adultification is just the process of projecting an adult level of maturity or understanding onto a child. And like, fat girls experience this, and girls of color, the darker you are, the more you experience this. So I really wanted to say, like, you know, this is a gift, and you absolutely get to have this too.
I mean, there's so much you said in there, but I think the what you said at the beginning in terms of people wanting to move you on from this conversation, and I wonder if it's that huge discomfort. I think people, particularly who are operating in positions of power and used to being in spaces of privilege, are can maybe take one topic at a time. So it's like, okay, right, if we're going to talk about racism, we can talk about racism and that alone.
Right.
And then, but if we're talking about diet culture, and if we're talking, you know, yeah, okay, it's not good for everyone and women in particular, maybe to be, or it's not good for people to be dieting. So we can tackle that, but to show the link between these two problems and how they're so interconnected, I think blows people's minds and will just make people feel so incredibly uncomfortable that I completely believe you and can imagine people moving you along in that conversation because of the discomfort I can see it causing.
I think what's interesting is like when I talk to audiences of color, this is all intuitive. There's nothing, right. Nobody's like not getting this. Nobody's like, oh my God, too much information. Frankly, I do think that there is a lot of knowledge in the bodies of people of color. Like even if they don't necessarily have that articulated linguistic understanding, quote unquote, like in the way that you can be like, oh, this is exactly what's happening in this moment. Mm-hmm. You kind of can feel it and you kind of know. And I think fun, and this goes back to a theme from earlier where it's like that concept of being on the edge of society, kind of being an outsider. People of color already always feel that way. Mm-hmm. And so there's a different level of commitment and a sense of like insiderness that it isn't as, I guess what I'm saying is like, I can tell a person of color, like the whole system's fucked. And they're like, yes, that sounds correct. And then it's a much different situation for a white person to hear that because they're just in a completely different position of the system. They're like inside, right? So it's like, I mean, it's literally like telling someone who's outside of a house that's falling apart, that house is falling apart. Tell the people inside the house that it's falling apart. It's much more distressing. And so, I mean, I have a lot of empathy, frankly, for both positions. So anyway, yeah, but like, I think that it ends up creating this reality where I do feel like, okay, let's move it along, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think then to the point of how people of color maybe fall into diet culture is through that proximity to whiteness and access to capital and acceptance and being less other. So, I mean, just everything you said, really just to echo it, is such a crucial part of the conversation that does get overlooked. So I'm just really glad that you're talking about it and that you've created that space for girls of color in particular through the book.
So, you know, you have told us so much. I mean, and in that last conversation, you told us so much about creating spaces for people who don't always have a space for themselves. What do you do to create a space for yourself and to look after yourself and to kind of, you know, I don't know, to make yourself feel at home in your body? What are the things you do?
I mean, so many things. I'm somebody who is very driven by my pleasure and my desire. You know, I really think that when I decided that I wasn't going to engage in diet culture anymore, I think I really opened up a line of communication with my body. And I was just writing about this the other day for my own personal like self, my journal, just sort of writing about like, wow, I really thought that I was just like trying to not have an eating disorder and diet anymore, but it led to all these unexpected connections in my body. Like I can just hear, it just is so obvious, and it's gotten to the point where if I don't like something or I don't want to do something, it's almost like unbearable to do it. And I really think our culture is so good at like shutting that voice down. And so I feel like that process of like taking care of myself feels very integrated and intuitive. And so like, I think, I mean, the example I'm thinking of right now is like last night I went to bed and I was so excited because I got these little like Madeleines with chocolate chips in them yesterday. And I was like, oh, I can't. Oh my God, like the coffee is going to be so good at this. The Madeleines, the butter, and the little chocolate chip surprises. And I was like legit, like had a hard time falling asleep because I was so stoked about these Madeleines and like this coffee. So I'm just like, for me, it's like, you know, that little thing where I'm like, I want a Madeleine with chocolate chips. I have procured it. I am now excited to have it in the morning. Like that's a tiny thing. And
yeah.
Like, you know,
no, it's like meeting your needs. It's listening to what your heart desires and finding a way to provide that for yourself. There's nothing more beautiful than that, truly.
Yes, 100%. So like those kinds of things. And then there's a lot of things I think that people kind of think of, like going out in nature or like meditating or, you know, eating when you're hungry, et cetera. Those are all really important self-care things. But I think in addition to that, I really try to make space to kind of trust my body, even when it kind of wants to do something that I'm like, oh, that's kind of odd. Okay, we haven't done that before, but you want to do it, sure. And like kind of, I don't know, like nurturing that inner child or that inner creative or something is how I do that. I have plants. I have two baby Netherland dwarf bunnies that certainly feel like they've opened up my heart. So that's also great.
Oh my goodness. Virgie, you've been such an incredible guest on The Body Protest. Before we go, how can we and our listeners find and support your work?
Yes, thank you for asking. I am most active in terms of social media on Instagram. So I'm at Virgie Tovar, V-I-R-G-I-E-T-O-V-A-R. You can go to my website, virgietovar.com. Also, listen to my podcast, Rebel Eaters Club. It's on Apple or Spotify or Stitcher or anywhere you get your podcasts. And then finally, I have a new book coming out in spring of 2022. It's a journal book that is, yes, it's like, you know, it's journaling towards a better relationship to your body. And there's going to be stickers. And there's this amazing illustrator who's going to do all the illustrations. I'm so excited. So that's coming out. And then I'm also, last thing, I've been working with a travel company lately. So I'm about to release a new trip, like a sort of like a body positive, like, you know, like body positive travel, if you will. So I'm going to be releasing a few of those over the next several months and over the next year. So mostly find updates on my Instagram.
It's Bali, right? I think I've seen it on your...
Yeah, I went to... So Bali sold out and like now we're... Okay, you could maybe be the first to know, like the next trip is to Italy. So we're going to be eating our way through Italy and I'm so excited.
Not even going.
So, Dr. Nadia... I'm feeling particularly riled up after that episode. I feel like Virgie talked beautifully about plus size fashion and about brands being more inclusive, which I know is actually very much in the same vein as your PhD. I was wondering if you could give us some delicious information, a little slurp of knowledge, and tell us a bit more about that.
Of course. Now that I do have my PhD, time for me to pull my finger out and share. So what's really funny about talking about PhDs is that obviously it's this whole big 80,000 word home of information. So maybe like to distill it. What I aim to do in my PhD is speak to people in fashion, advertising and beauty to see how we can be more inclusive in terms of body size representation, very much through the lens of corporate social responsibility.
So Nadia, could you tell me what corporate social responsibility is?
Of course. So corporate social responsibility, or CSR, is a business term that refers to a business's voluntary contributions to society beyond its economic and legal commitments. So a simple way of thinking about it is how they, quote, do good in the world beyond creating their products or services. The term is a little bit old-fashioned in practice, and there's loads and loads of other terms that get circulated. So anything from creating shared value to social purpose to corporate citizenship to ESG, which is environmental, social and corporate governance. And there are just loads and loads more. But I found CSR quite useful as a broad conceptual like umbrella framework, because also there are many variations in terms of how businesses engage on social issues. So this could be anything from like giving money to charity to investing in their employees' well-being. Also, probably should say that CSR is not new. Corporate social responsibility is not new. It kind of dates back to the 1900s. You have examples like Rockefeller, who gave away large sums of money to social causes. But also what's useful to think about in terms of CSR is that it's not always good. So although it's how companies do good in the world and contribute to society, it's not always as simple as that. It gets a bit murky.
Well, is it how they're trying to be perceived as good as well as that? That's the other side of it.
Spot on.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's spot scary on when a company wants us to like them because they're a company, not a person.
Right. I think that's spot on in terms of, is it a smokescreen? Mm. What are they trying to, what's going on behind
especially,
I know, what else is happening? I think we are, as consumers, are more and more aware of what businesses are doing. And we're always looking at disconnects, right? So if a company is saying, oh, we're a feminist brand, and then they don't look after their female employees, like,
yeah, it's like something's not adding up for me.
Yeah, exactly. And I think people see that more and more.
Or even, I mean, slightly different to that, but, you know, recently with Rixo saying, I feel bad roasting Rixo, but I actually am going to, of saying, guys, we just want to celebrate all bodies, so you're welcome. We've added a size 16. And you're like, that's not checking out for me. Obviously, that's on a much smaller scale, but it's that kind of cognitive dissonance.
And that's exactly it. It's a really complex thing to think about, but really, really interesting, and really interesting thinking about it in terms of inclusivity and representation of bodies. And I think what Virgie was saying is really interesting, because it's, you have these two perspectives where it's like, I'm doing this as a part of my social purpose. So I really believe in the representation and inclusion of people of different body shapes, sizes, abilities, etc. And like, that's really part of the ethos of the company. Or they're just like, you know what, I'm going to make a buck here and I'm really going to go for it. And very much like how Virgie said, like, I don't care about the motive. Yeah. I don't think many people do. It's like,
if one,
however
feels
we're getting
the other,
to the end point.
Completely. It's like, however we get there, I don't care if people are doing it for dodgy reasons. I just want to be able to wear Rixo. You know, it's...
Yeah. But yeah, that's totally the point. In the interest of transparency, like, my work is completely funded by Dove, so the Unilever brand. And Dove very much is part of that social purpose. And then obviously they fund all of the research that we're doing and the getting body image intervention tools out...
Globally. So, I mean, what were some of the things that surprised you most about your findings?
Good question. It's hard to know whether it's surprising or not. But so with one of the studies, I'll just focus on one for this little slurp. So the first study I did was, I mean, it was just so, so interesting. I spoke to 45 different executives working in fashion, advertising and beauty at really quite senior levels. So that was fun in itself. Well, every time I talk about this, I'm always like, oh, the shame of it is that I can't say who I spoke to. Yeah, I can't say which companies were represented.
For the sake of the story, can we all visualise that it's Meryl Streep and Devil Wears Prada?
We can. that's great. I mean, so, I did go into some of the major international advertising agencies. But what was really interesting from what they were saying is that I did really get that piece that Virgie said, in terms of there's almost like these two different ways of looking about it. So, and there were people who generally, I believe, care. So it was interesting speaking. Most of the people I spoke to were women, and a lot of them shared their own stories of struggling with negative body image or not feeling represented when they were growing up, and now they're in a position of power, they can enact change. And some of them were very candid in the fact that they said, I have replicated the ideal in my past. I've done that. And there's been a couple of different things that have flicked the switch. So the Me Too movement, I think, was powerful.
Wow. So that changed a lot of kind of women in power's minds, essentially, of maybe when they had been conforming to, I don't know, societal expectations, they were like, and fuck this. Now let's actually push the agenda that serves us now.
Yeah. And I think it's going back to that idea of cognitive dissonance, right? So if you are really behind the Me Too movement, like, you're only showing objectified images of women and a very narrow exclusionary representation of women, there is that disconnect. So I think that's definitely part of it. Obviously, people are talking about the bottom line and profit, and it's not as easy as it sounds. Like, and people did talk through some of the different challenges. And also, when you think about businesses, it's a whole ecosystem. So you might, as the senior creative director at an ad agency, be really behind inclusive representation and really want to have people of different sizes and ethnicities and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But because an advertising agency is paid by the brand, if they don't buy into it, then you're stuck, right? Because then it's positions of power and who's holding the purse strings. So you could be then stuck. Obviously, it depends on the relationship and if you've been working with each other for a long time and you can kind of work and kind of push people a little bit. And I think there was a lot of that, how to be an agent of change from within the company. And then the other thing, of course, which will come of no surprise to you and I think many of our listeners, is that people are really stuck on weight and health.
Yeah.
Really, really stuck.
That does not surprise me.
So they were like, yeah, sure. Like, we want to be more inclusive. We understand that showing very skeletally thin women is not useful or healthy or good or what we want to put out in the world.
The thought that terrifies them even more. Yeah, the thing that fills them with even more dread is like, but what if she's fat?
Yeah, and very much into the public health rhetoric of, like, we don't want to be promoting ill health by, like, promoting people in larger bodies. Like, there's like a fear around that.
But also because I think that is, unfortunately, probably a lot of the shouting that would be done at them if they, you know, in most of their positions, because, you know, living as a fat woman, there's always some fucker saying I'm promoting obesity. And I'm like, no, I'm just fat and living my life. You know what I mean? And so companies must be getting that on an insane scale if that's, you know, that they do anything that goes against the grain.
That's it. And I think that's part of what holds them back, because in society, we do have these fat phobic attitudes. And obviously, at the end of the day, a company is a company and their purpose is to make money. So if consumers are like, this is toxic and awful, it's always going to push them.
But I imagine they must be hearing toxic and awful from both sides. Like, I kind of feel like it, at this point, that's when it becomes about the social responsibility, surely, because it's like, okay, well, we're weighing up which is more toxic and which is more awful.
Completely it. And I think there is a lot of education to be done, not just for people who work in fashion, advertising and beauty. I think it's a societal education that needs to be done about weight and health, right, that we've spoken about so much on the podcast. And I think I also don't want to... I know it's easy to hate on businesses, but...
Yeah, a lot of them are trying. A lot of people... Well, look, there are people behind businesses and people are trying.
Exactly. And also, like, even within my own field, even within public health, as we know and have discussed, people in public health, people in psychology, people in the eating disorder field, there are still these views about weight that are problematic.
Because it's a systemic thing.
It's not just them and them alone being hateful.
Fat phobia is a systemic issue. It is something much larger. It's connected to so many other systemic issues. It's like, the fact is, there will always be people butting heads on this until that changes from an earlier age.
Right, so then you've got some companies who are almost brave enough to be on that pedestal and keep pushing boundaries. But I think also you need to be, in some ways, able to resist the pushback.
Yeah.
And whether that's because you're such a big company that you can ride the wave and you can buffer the storm, or that you just believe in it so fundamentally that you just, from a moral level, couldn't do anything else. So I think it's really interesting. It's really complex. It'll be interesting. I mean, I'd love to speak to the same 45 people again now, just like 3 years on.
To see how the landscape's changed.
Yeah, because I think it has.
Because things are so different now. Yeah.
Yeah, I think this is a really fast-moving topic and how people are thinking about it. And I think there's more education out in the world all the time. So it's really interesting. And also, I think with more companies doing it, the more emboldened other companies feel to do it also. It does fall under the umbrella of social responsibility for me, because it is body image and appearance-based discrimination are social justice issues. Yeah. They are social issues. They are public health issues. It is a way for companies to improve public health, to address some of the toxicity in our world, and they can also make money from it. So it's win-win-win.
Nadia, for people who can't get enough of your tasty, tasty knowledge noodles, is there a place where we can read more of this information?
With the study I was just talking about with the 45 business professionals in advertising, fashion and beauty, I have got that paper written up and it's published in the journal Body Image, although it is behind a paywall. But we are going to create a Google Drive so all of you, our lovely listeners, can access all the papers that we talk about on the podcast, because, you know, science shouldn't be
behind a paywall.
Yeah, science should not be behind a paywall. So we're happy to share and set that Google Drive up. And we'll put a link in our show notes. And that'll be the first paper in there, my little PhD study.
Nadia, thank you so much for sharing your delicious knowledge with us today. There'll be many of more of these to come.
Oh, well, it's a treat. I love noodles.
Thank you for listening to The Body Protest.
We really hope you've enjoyed this episode, and it would mean the world to us if you could subscribe, rate and review.
You can follow Honey on Instagram at HoneyKinney.
And you can follow Nadia at Nadia.Craddock.
This podcast is produced and edited by the glorious Daisy Grant.
And it's brought to you by the Pink Protest Podcast Network.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.